live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Congressman Mark Molinaro, who represents New York's 19th district. It's not only including much of Radio Catskill's listening area, it's also an extremely competitive congressional district in this election year. We'll talk about some of the issues that Molinaro is facing with a diverse population, and also his claims that former President Donald Trump's Manhattan trial was politically motivated. La Voz, the magazine for Spanish-speaking residents in the Hudson Valley, celebrates its 20th anniversary. We'll speak to managing editor Mariel Fiore about the two decades of providing resources for the community and the community she's helped build. Plus, Deepwater Literary Festival, the founders of Afro Chic Today, and Science Stories with Joe Johnson. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Russian President Vladimir Putin is in North Korea today for talks with that country's reclusive leader, Kim Jong-un. As NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow, the visit marks Putin's first to North Korea in nearly a quarter century.
Putin and Kim meet facing allegations by the U.S. and its allies that Russia is providing sensitive technologies to Pyongyang's nuclear and missile weapons programs in exchange for access to North Korean munitions for the war in Ukraine. While Moscow and Pyongyang deny any weapons trade, the two leaders signed a new strategic partnership agreement that acknowledged it as a possibility going forward. Speaking before cameras, Putin said the agreement meant Russia would not rule out developing military technical cooperation with North Korea, noting Pyongyang's objective and balanced position on Ukraine. Kim Jong-un has wholly endorsed the Russian invasion, calling it a sacred war against the West. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Hot, dry, windy weather is fueling wildfires in the southwest. In southern New Mexico, two fast-growing fires left at least one person dead near Rudisio, and the village, with around 7,000 people, is completely evacuated. Casey Counts from member station KRWG has more.
About 7,000 people in and around Rudoso are still evacuated. The State Forestry Division has said about 1,400 structures have been lost. Now, that's an update by last night. Earlier in the day, it was 500 structures. So you can just see how quickly things are changing there. It's unclear at this point how many of those are homes versus businesses. We've seen pictures and videos circulating that appear to show homes and some well-known businesses that are destroyed.
Casey Counts reporting. The fires have burned more than 22,000 acres, and the cause of the fires are under investigation. Rain, though, is forecast in the area tomorrow. Meanwhile, millions of people in the Midwest and Northeast are dealing with soaring temperatures and high humidity. The stock market is closed today in observance of the Juneteenth holiday. And NPR Scott Horsley reports both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ hit record highs on Tuesday.
Chipmaker NVIDIA continues to soar, with the market value now topping $3.3 trillion. NVIDIA has surpassed Microsoft to become the most valuable public company. NVIDIA sales have more than tripled in the last year, thanks to roaring demand for its artificial intelligence chips. Inflation in the UK has cooled all the way down to 2%, thanks in part to falling food prices. It's the first time in almost 3 years the country's cost of living increase has hit that target. Later this week, investors get an update on the U.S. housing market, which has been weighed down by high interest rates. Sluggish home sales are also a drag on furniture sales, down nearly 7% in the last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And U.S. futures contracts are trading in mixed territory. You're listening to NPR News. Vice President Kamala Harris helped open an Atlanta campaign office with a Juneteenth block party. Sam Greenglass from member station WABE has more.
Behind a low brick building a few blocks from Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthplace, voters sporting Biden-Harris t-shirts enjoyed barbecue, snow cones, and a DJ.
Somebody asked me if I was moving here. I said, maybe.
Harris last visited Atlanta a few days ago and has been a regular presence lately. Outside the still unfinished campaign office, she proposed making voter registration a new Juneteenth tradition.
And we're never going to let anybody take our power from us. We will never let anybody silence us. That's what this election is about. And the people of Georgia are going to make the decision. And the decision will be 4 more years.
Thank Next week, President Biden and former President Trump are set to debate just a few miles away. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
And Harris has been a key surrogate in Georgia as the Biden campaign courts black voters. Texas is bracing for the first tropical storm of the hurricane season, with the entire coast of the state under a tropical storm warning through tomorrow. The National Weather Service says a potential tropical cyclone is moving westward with wind gusts up to 51 miles an hour. Flash flooding is possible, and there are already reports of coastal flooding. And the storm moves inland tomorrow afternoon. It will become Tropical Storm Alberto. The governor has activated all personnel and resources, including the Texas National Guard, to help. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Congressman Mark Molinaro represents New York's 19th district, which not only includes much of Radio Catskill's listening area, but it's also a highly competitive district in this election year. The outcome here could significantly impact the political balance in the House this November. In an interview with Radio Catskill, Molinaro discussed the challenges of representing such a politically diverse district. He addressed several key issues, including infrastructure projects, access to contraception, and the opioid crisis. Molinaro also elaborated on his belief that former President Donald Trump's trial in Manhattan was politically motivated. Trump faced charges of falsifying business records to sway the 2016 presidential election and was convicted on all 34 felony counts. According to Representative Molinaro, this outcome reflects what he calls, quote, one-party rule in New York State. Yesterday, Congressman Mark Molinaro spoke with Jason Dole, beginning with a discussion of the million-dollar old Route 17 corridor infrastructure project.
It's a forward-thinking proposal. I was happy to be able to secure approximately $7 million in federal assistance to communities across upstate New York. As I've said before, far too many of us, we know this, right? Our communities send dollars to Washington and too often don't get the attention or respect that they deserve from Washington and Albany. And so it's been a real focus of mine to make sure that we get those dollars back. And in the case of this Town of Liberty project, it's an extension of water and sewer pipe and infrastructure. So the concept, of course, is in order to get access to quality water and sewer infrastructure, you either have to shoulder that burden as a local community all on your own or partner with developers as a public-private partnership and or federal or state agencies. Our $1 million, the $1 million directed back to Liberty, will extend water and sewer piping, which will allow for access to municipal water, municipal sewer system. Also will allow for the community, the Town of Liberty, to really advance a few shovel-ready projects for economic development. So it's truly a win-win for the community. And from my perspective, as a former mayor and somebody who works regularly with the towns, villages, and cities that make up upstate New York, it's a big need, and the only way to address it is by partnering together in order to make the infrastructure investments possible.
Right, and as you note, there's potential economic benefits as well as just community and quality of life benefits to this project. Funding for it was secured through the bipartisan fiscal year 2024 appropriations bill. Can you talk just a little bit about the process of advocating for and securing these funds? Any challenges you encountered along the way? Anything you can let us know about, how the sausage is made without getting too far into the meat?
Not too far into the detail. As the second most bipartisan member of Congress and actually just ranked now the fifth most effective member of Congress, I can tell you that this doesn't happen without bringing people together to come to agreement. And so the negotiation overall on the budgets, right, the 2024 budget, the appropriations bills, really required a great deal of negotiation and advocacy by members like me in the room, saying that one, we have to respect our taxpayers. We have to spend more efficiently. We have to drive down costs where we can. But if we're going to take money from taxpayers, they ought to be able to see the return on that investment. And so specifically advocating for the 15 or 16 projects that we were able to work with local communities to achieve, you know, just requires making sure that we're always in front of those appropriators, the members of the committees that ultimately make these decisions. And I spent a lot of time advocating for the projects like the one in the town of Liberty and the others that we were able to secure this year. But I'll say again, the only way that any of this gets done is if we demand the federal government pay more attention to communities like ours, respect taxpayers a little bit more, and work in a bipartisan way to deliver results.
What other infrastructure improvements beyond this project, you know, right here in Liberty, where I happen to be broadcasting from, but, you know, for the rest of Sullivan County, for the rest of New York's 19th district, what other infrastructure improvements are on their way, are you working on, are you looking at, or hearing from your constituents are needed?
Well, that's a big and tall order. Listen, we hear it all over the district, and we know it. High cost of housing, access to daycare, mental health and substance use disorder assistance, and infrastructure, meaning water, sewer, highways, roads, and bridges, remain a top priority for taxpayers and local leaders. And so whether it's $1 million in Liberty or several million in Binghamton for a veteran service center or drainage and highway reconstruction in the city of Binghamton, we've been obviously working hard to direct dollars to a city of Norwich, another water project this year, advocating for $5 million in Bloomingburg for water wastewater treatment assistance. Town of Rockland, $5 million for water projects, $3.5 million to the Rock Hill Fire Station Fire Department for expansion of their fire station. These are all just a part of the projects that we're advocating for, and certainly a piece of what residents and taxpayers hope we pay attention to.
So we're in the midst of what's going to be a big election year. And while we have you, I'd like to ask you about some things that you're working on that relate to this and the bigger picture here. You're running for re-election in New York's 19th, you know, after your first term. It's right. A massive district. It goes from all the way from Tioga County to Columbia County. Sullivan County is kind of in the middle of it. Yet again, New York's 19th has been redrawn slightly. Yet again, it's one of the most competitive congressional districts in play. One of those districts people are going to be watching far outside of the district, because it may play a role in determining which party controls the House. And it's also a very mixed district politically. I feel like I can see you trying to navigate that divide as you serve constituents with very different viewpoints. And sometimes you're standing with majority of your party, sometimes not. And I thought that was interesting. The designation that you gave there about like how ranking yourself as how bipartisan you are. Is that like an outside organization did that? Or is that just like you comparing your voting record to some of your colleagues?
No, the Luer Center, which actually is the expert in both evaluating and then judging members as to their level of willingness to work across the aisle, develops that ranking. I'm the second most bipartisan member of Congress. The Congressional Research Center also identified me as the fifth most effective member of the entire Congress, House and Senate. And so I just would say to your point, this district is a balance, and I love it. It is a mix of ideology, and I love it. It is a mix of both backgrounds and experiences, and I love it. And so from my perspective, this is a part of the state that I know, I love, and I have served really as a community member for the last 30 years. I know the community leaders, I know the business leaders, and I care deeply about the people I serve. And just for your reference, you know, again, everything from mental health and substance use disorder assistance, we were able to deliver the HIDA designation for Sullivan County to address the opioid epidemic. Obviously, as I mentioned, work across the aisle at the local level and in Congress, really with anyone who's honest and earnest about trying to solve problems, and focus on delivering dollars and reinvesting in our communities, all critically important. I just would say to you that, a district like this, demands a member of Congress who knows it, who loves it, who's lived it, and ultimately who can speak on behalf of the diverse opinions. And I tell people all the time, I may not always get it right, But I strive to make sure that the people I represent, irrespective of your party or background, have your voice heard. And that, for me, is the priority.
You mentioned that high-intensity drug trafficking area designation. I wanted to ask you, where are we with opioids right now in our area? Because even just this week, you're referring to New York 19th as the epicenter of the opioid crisis, and you're calling on New York Governor Hochul to approve an additional overdose reversal drug. Is that the case?
It is. So I've been working with Sullivan County actually to bring about a treatment center, kind of like the model we established in Dutchess. I was grateful to be a part of developing the most comprehensive community-based mental health infrastructure in the state. It is now the model that the state of New York uses. And so we're hopeful that we can bring that about in Sullivan. We've connected Sullivan leaders with the federal authorities that handle the HIDTA designation and the investment from law enforcement. And yeah, upstate New York is the epicenter of the opioid epidemic, with sadly among the highest rates of overdose deaths. And keep in mind, a lot of times, you know, politicians use those statistics to make a point. I want to remind folks that those are lives. Those are individuals. They didn't choose to be addicts. They didn't choose to fall prey to substance use disorder. And these are somebody's loved one who now are no longer with us. And we ought to be putting our real emphasis on trying to intervene early, enforce the law, and also intervene early to help people navigate and hopefully prevent incidents of overdose. And that's really been a priority focus for me.
Earlier this month, there was the contraception bill. You came out in favor of it. A majority of your Republican colleagues did not, so it didn't go forward. Can you tell us about your support for the contraception bill, and where does the issue go from here?
Yeah, well, first it needs to start with respect, right? We have to, and I do. We just have to respect the difficult choice women and families have to make as they navigate bringing a child bringing a life into the world, building their families. I think access to contraception is critically important. I think access to IVF is important as a way of bringing new life into the world. And so, yeah, I became and remain committed as the first and only Republican to sponsor legislation that would protect access to contraception, to birth control. I think it's important, and became the first to sponsor access, guaranteed access to IVF. But I think ultimately what is really important is this: we build access to prenatal and neonatal care, that women and families know that we support the difficult choices they have to make in life, and that in a community like ours, a rural community like ours, there's access, which is one of the reasons I've been a strong advocate of federally qualified health clinics and telemedicine as a means of accessing both physical and mental health care.
An example of you siding more with your party, sticking with the majority on messaging, came on May 30th. We learned a New York jury found Donald Trump guilty on all 34 counts of falsifying business records to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. And within a half hour of us all getting that verdict, you released a statement that said, in part, quote, this is how we're going to do politics now, not through spirited debates, but by weaponizing the justice and court system to attack a political rival right before the election. So I'm wondering, do you really feel our justice and court system have been weaponized for political ends? And if so, how and who's doing this?
Well, I have to say, in New York, single-party rule has led to absolute incidents of corruption that either don't go enforced or prosecuted because of the decisions, sadly, of people in power in this state. Or in some cases, we've seen the system used to gang up against political rivals. You don't have to like or dislike the former president or even this president just to know that there's a reason that Alvin Bragg's predecessor chose not to take this particular case to court. There's a reason that the federal prosecutors didn't take this case to court, and there's a reason that the Federal Election Commission didn't take this case to court, and there's a reason no district attorney in the country has ever used the state law in a contorted way to prosecute what ultimately they charged was a felony. There's a reason that no one's ever done it. And it's because it's just not appropriate. Again, you don't have to like the guy or dislike the guy, just to know that having, and for me, having lived and grown up in New York State politics and New York State public service for the last 30 years. This was a contortion that was unnecessary and hardly explainable. And therefore, I just believe that elections should be influenced by voters, and that in this particular case, it didn't prove warranted. And that's a position that I take very seriously and genuinely and authentically as somebody who's seen New York State politics. Think of all the times that we knew that the former Democratic Speaker of the New York State Assembly, Shelley Silver, had conducted himself in a improper way, and yet there was no prosecution. We knew that Andrew Cuomo's office was buying and selling access to contracts. In fact, the state comptroller pointed it out, and the powers that be said that they weren't going to prosecute. So picking and choosing winners and losers when it comes in that way is just not right for an elected district attorney, who, by the way, turns his back on violent and heinous crimes in the city of Manhattan. So I just look at it that way. I understand that everything is looked through the veil of sort of national politics. But as somebody who spent his entire life trying to get government to actually do its job well, I just see this as an abuse of the district attorney's authority.
Is there evidence that there's this political influence? I know it sounds like you're kind of saying like it feels like that could be the case based on your experience with, you know, New York politics. But is there actual evidence in this case that you know, justice has been perverted, as you're saying?
Well, good question. CNN contributor and former colleague of Alvin Bragg's actually worked in the office, opined on this at length. It's a contortion of state law in order to apply in order to gain a federal prosecution or federal law in order to get a state prosecution. That specifically points to the contortion of justice. But I would also say Alvin Bragg ran for this particular office, saying he was going to use his office to go after the former president. And so a district attorney that outwardly says my goal in life is to go find a political opponent and prosecute, when again his Democratic predecessor said he couldn't, district attorneys across the country said they couldn't, the Department of Justice said they couldn't, that clearly is a suggestion that the system was contorted in order to bring about the prosecution.
Right, I understand other people didn't bring the case, but like this is a Manhattan district attorney brought the case. It was a violation of New York State election law, and a jury found, he was guilty of that 34 times. He actually brought the case, and it was successful. Like, is there anything that's actually wrong with the case? That actually says, oh yeah, clearly this is all, you know, just a political thing here, because it sounds like. Well. Anyway, yeah, that's the question.
Yeah, I understand the question. Your description, though, of it is without questioning you, that's not actually what they prosecuted. So the point is that this was legal gymnastics meant to go after an opponent. And yes, the fact that others who with the same legal brains and the same understanding of federal and state law say it can't be prosecuted is a suggestion, if not a direct implication that this district attorney did what they knew could not be done. And so, again, the context of the question is important, but to say, well, since, he did it, therefore it's right, that doesn't play either. And again, I just think in the context of an election, voters should be making this determination. And again, there's a reason others could not and did not want to make this case. And I think the threshold to bring such litigation against a former president, Republican or Democrat, is so high, must be so clear that there cannot be question. And in this case, I'm sorry, knowing New York State law as I do, and certainly knowing New York State politics as I do, it is clear to me that this was a contortion of law.
Well, I thank you for going over all that and sharing your thoughts and doing it so thoroughly. Representative Molinaro, before we go, when's the next time we might see you in this part of New York's 19th?
Well, I was just out there earlier this week. I'll be back in the Sullivan region, Sullivan County, in another week and a half. We've got a number of projects we're working on. As I tell people, no matter your party affiliation or who you voted for, just tap me on the shoulder and offer a question, offer a complaint, offer a suggestion, or reach out to the offices at molinaro.house.gov, molinaro.house.gov. And listen, I think it's important, no matter what the issue is, My goal is to be transparent and open to the people I serve. It's an honor to represent the people of upstate New York. And every day, I try to go to battle on your behalf.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah, happy to, and be well.
That's Jason Dole speaking to Congressman Mark Molinaro from New York's 19th District. We'll take a break, and when we come back, science stories with Joe Johnson, including the shift from El Nino to La Nina and what it means for the weather patterns this summer. And get this, a fungus is turning cicadas into horny zombies. Yep, we'll be right back. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
On the TED Radio Hour, NYU professor Scott Galloway says older Americans have failed to live up to the social contract between generations.
We talk a lot about income inequality, but we don't talk a lot about generational inequality. But we have purposely transferred wealth and opportunity from young people to old people.
Ideas about generation gaps and how to bridge them. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Joe Johnson is a retired Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer. He regularly brings us science stories that have caught his eye. And we're talking today about some good news about Voyager 1, that spacecraft from 1977, still going strong. The shift from El Nino to La Nina. And here's a good one. And remember, it's science. Some of the cicadas temporarily overtaking parts of the eastern and southern U.S. are turning into sex-crazed, quote, zombies, thanks to a fungus that tears off their genitals but still drives them to keep mating nonetheless. Here's Joe.
El Nino and La Nina, you may remember from Earth Science class, El Nino and La Nina. So what this story is about is it's about NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, is predicting that El Nino is ending and a La Nina will take hold by late summer. Now, let's talk about this. This is called the ENSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation, and it affects weather all around the world. So El Nino happens when in the tropical Pacific, the easterly winds that normally kind of spread the heat around weaken a little bit, and that allows warmer air to pool in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean. And this makes the eastern Pacific surface seawater warmer and the western Pacific cooler. And this is where we've been since May 2023. So this warmer seawater in the eastern Pacific causes more evaporation, more storms, and more rain in the eastern Pacific. And so places like Peru and Ecuador experience a lot of rain and a lot of flooding in, you know, those parts of South America because there's more warm air there. There's more warm water there. The opposite is true in the western Pacific. This cooler weather causes less storms, less rain, and it can lead to droughts and crop failure in places like Australia and India and Asia. Now, in the U.S., this affects us in a couple of different ways. In the southeast area and the Gulf states, they're going to get more rain, and it's going to be warmer, which they have had recently because we've been in this El Nino. In the northeast here, El Nino causes us to be a little warmer and a little drier. And we've had that going on for the last year. It also reduces the number of hurricanes that we'll see. Now, this pattern, this El Nino pattern, is ending right now. And the La Nina, they say, is going to take place in late summer. And what that means is it's the opposite. The easterly winds get stronger. They push the warmer water, seawater, the surface water, to the west over by Australia and India and Asia. And like I said, it has an opposite effect. So in Australia and Asia, they get more rainfall and flooding. And in South America, less rainfall, cooler temperatures, and many times crop failures.
You know, historically, this seemed to be somewhat predictable, but global temperatures are rising. How does this play into climate change?
Climate change was originally called global warming because the idea here is that the Earth is getting warmer. It's retaining more heat. Less heat is getting back to space because of increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So because this is all driven by heat, this is all made stronger and more intense by global warming, by climate change.
What can we expect here in our area in the next few months?
Well, La Nina has different set of effects in the U.S. The Southwest is going to be drier and warmer. The Northeast is going to be colder and stormier. And since this is taking effect later this summer and into this winter, we could be looking at a colder and stormier and snowier winter. Strangely enough, it can increase the number of hurricanes. NOAA has predicted an 85% chance that we're going to get 17 to 25 named storms this hurricane season. So it could be bad in that way, too.
Quick question about hurricane season. We've talked about that before, where it's expected to be an active hurricane season. Mm-hmm. It's still pretty early in the season.
It is. The ocean really hasn't warmed up enough yet.
These are more likely to happen a little bit later as things get warmer.
Yes.
All right. Voyager 1 back online 15 billion miles away. It woke up. Let's remind folks there were some technical difficulties.
Right. We talked about this back, I believe, in March. And we talked about how Voyager 1 was launched in 1977. It's been traveling through space for over 46 years, coming up on 47 years. Its original mission was to photograph and study the Jupiter and Saturn systems. And then what it did was it looped up north of the solar system and basically left the plane of the solar system. We got fantastic photographs of each planet, great science, close-ups of all of the Galilean satellites around Jupiter, just amazing science. This is a real tribute to NASA and JPL. And so this thing has been traveling through space at about 38,000 miles per hour. And it's currently, like you said, about 15 billion miles away.
Yeah, I would expect after 47 years there might be some problems. But it was kind of not making sense.
There were originally 10 instruments on board, scientific instruments, and they've turned 6 of them off. And other ones have malfunctioned, so they're down to 4. But you're right. Back in November, on November 14th, it started sending gibberish. And they didn't know what was going on. Now, you got to remember that this is a 1970s era. This thing was launched in 77. This is a 1977 era computer, best they had in those days. But if you remember computers from those days, they were not nearly as powerful as they are today. Your cell phone has about 500,000 times more memory than the Voyager spacecraft does. Yeah, it's crazy the amount of technological improvement that's happened. But what they found out, they studied it. And remember, this is old computer language. They had to pull people out of retirement to come back and tell them what was going on. They figured out that a chip in the flight data system went bad. And that represents about 3% of the memory on board. They don't know why it went bad. It could have been hit by a charged particle. It could have just been age. I mean, it's 47 years old. It's been flying through space. And so what they did to fix it was they took the code that was stored on that chip and they moved it to other chips. Identifying the problem was the real issue here. They had to figure out what was going on. And so they moved the code to other chips. And on April 18th, they sent up a new set of instructions. Now, it takes about 22 and a half hours to get there at the speed of light, because this thing, as you said, is about 15 billion miles away from the Earth. On April 20th, 2 days later, they received good data. They got good telemetry. They got both science and engineering data again. They fixed it at a distance of 15 billion miles. I mean,
that's amazing.
Yeah, they certainly couldn't make a home visit to fix it. But that's just, to me, is just amazing. And once again, a real tribute to NASA and JPL and the engineers there.
Yeah, I mean, it was originally launched in, as we said, 1977 for a 5-year flyby mission to study Jupiter and Saturn, and still going strong.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to our final story of the day, and I think we saved the best for last.
We definitely saved the best for last. Okay. Yes, we're going to talk about cicada sex zombies.
You said it, not me.
Well, I picked this story because yes. I knew you'd appreciate
it. Well, what's going on here with these horny cicadas?
Well, they're all horny because they're trying to reproduce. That's the whole idea of the emergence. Let me back up a little bit. There are periodical cicadas that emerge on at different periods. And this year, a 17-year cycle cicada and a 13-year cycle cicada are emerging at the same time. So they're calling it a mega spawn. Okay. A total of 15 different broods. So we're talking billions and billions, maybe trillions of insects. Now, there's 16 states affected. New York State is not one of them. mostly down in, well, they're Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. So more down south. Okay. And it started in late April and it's moving northwards. They're, you know, as the soil warms up, they're starting to emerge. Now, as they come out of the ground, if they encounter a spore of this fungus called Massapora cicadina, it will infect them. And the males have a particular, the females get infected too, but the males exhibit what's called zombie behavior. What happens is the tissue, you know, it infects them, it grows inside them, and it replaces about a third of their abdomen, including their sex organs. In fact, their sex organs fall off as part of the this infection with the zombie. And it replaces, like I said, about a third of the abdomen. Now, this fungus causes the male cicadas to become hypersexual. It actually changes their behavior. And they start mating with every female they can get near. And they even start imitating females so that other males will try. The females flick their wings in a certain way to get the males to, to attract the males, to tell them they're ready to mate. And these infected zombies are doing the same thing. So they have males trying to mate with them, and when they do, they get infected with the fungal spores too.
If they don't have sex organs because the fungus has caused them to go away, how are they? They're trying to mate. They're not actually mating.
Right. They're not actually mating. But it's the back of their abdomen where the fungus comes out, where the sex organs were. And so they're actually rubbing those up against the other cicadas and transferring spores to them and infecting them with the same virus, or I'm sorry, with the same fungus.
There's so much to unpack here. So if it gets infected, there are some that are not infected.
Right.
Well, then that crazy zombie cicada then infect the other?
Yes, it'll change its behavior too. And so it's about a 3 to 4 week cycle that the cicadas are before they emerge, before they die.
They don't live that long.
Yeah, they don't. They don't live that long as adults. They live 17 years and 13 years in the ground as nymphs.
Once they come up.
Right, right. And so they will affect like multiple sessions or multiple, I don't want to say generations, but multiple levels of these cicadas. And so this fungus is doing everything it can to infect other cicadas. It's just part of its evolution. And the really weird thing to me, at least, is that the mushroom, the fungus, also produces a very strong stimulant. It's almost like it's in the amphetamine family. It's called carthenone. And it's actually in bath salts, the crazy drug bath salts. And this causes the infected cicadas to go into hyperdrive. You know, they're always going because they're always being stimulated.
The line in the NPR article says, it's not clear how many cicadas are infected or whether they're, quote, high out of their minds. It's not easy being a cicada these days.
It's not.
Wow.
It's not.
So
it only infects about 5%. That's their best estimate. It only does about 5% of the cicada broods.
Would this impact animals that prey on the cicada?
It definitely could. The amphetamines, especially if they're, being eaten by birds or some other animal, that they could get to a level where it could affect them.
It could spread as we see this emergence happen.
Sure, sure. Now, what happens in the end is the cicada basically tears open and spreads spores all over the ground. And those spores lay dormant in the ground until the next generation of cicadas are emerging. The nymphs are crawling up to the surface. They've been sucking juice out of plant roots for the last 17 and 13 years. And as they come to the surface, if they encounter one of these spores, they get infected, and then the cycle starts all over again.
And it can't infect human beings?
No, no.
Can you imagine you're underground for 17 years just waiting to get out there and do your thing, and then all of a sudden you go nuts?
Yep.
Poor cicadas.
This is the craziness that is science.
That is the craziness that is science, and only Joe Johnson can bring us the craziness that is science. You do bring us these stories, and you go through and take a look at what you like, but you're asking folks if they have something they see to reach out.
I read a lot of science every week. I'm constantly searching on stories because I find this all so fascinating. But if any of our listeners out there have anything that they run across that they would like us to talk about, please just drop me an email at joejohnson@wjffradio.org.
Joe Johnson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the only print Spanish language magazine in our region, La Voz. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. La Voz is the award-winning magazine in Spanish, distributed to 10 counties across the Hudson Valley, serving over 150,000 Hispanic readers. La Voz is celebrating its 20th anniversary as the only print Spanish language magazine in the region on Saturday at Bard College. Reporter Maren Scotton spoke to managing editor Mariel Fiore, and she's also the host of La Voz en Breve, Mondays at 11 at night on Radio Catskill. And she talked to her about the two decades of providing resources for Spanish-speaking immigrants in the area and the vibrant community she's helped build through the publication.
Tell me what La Voz is all about, who you guys are for, what you do, and the reason you started.
Well, La Voz is in Spanish. It's the only print Spanish language publication of the area. The basic level is just a resource guide. We have a resource guide that a lot of people tell me that they make copies of it and distribute at the English classes because we don't print so many for everyone. So they make copies of that. It's also available in the website, lavoz.bard.edu. So at the very basic level is the resource guide. It's what to do when, you know, these different situations. There's how to navigate the system. We have a teacher with a column called Ser Padres, parenting column, you know, parenting in the United States, in the school system in the United States, right? And New York in particular. We have a column on mental health with a holistic psychologist. It's called El Poder del Amor, The Power of Love. We have another column, and now we go more beyond the basic things, but also breaking the stereotypes about what people imagine in their minds, what a Latino immigrant is. So, for example, we have a column called La Esquina de las Artes, the Arts Corner section, Sueño Americano, the American Dream section. So whatever that person's American dream is and how they are fulfilling that dream. It's not about how did I get rich in America. It's not that, not at all. It's about how do these people serve their community and find meaning in helping other people.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about the celebration that you guys have coming up.
Okay, so excited about this. So next Saturday, June 22nd, from 6 to 10 p.m., we're having a party. They call it in people in Puerto Rico because the performers are Puerto Ricans. It's Alex Torres and his Latin orchestra, 12-member orchestra. This is amazing. It's going to be super good. Alex Torres was on my radio show as well. He said that vamos a tirar las puertas por la ventana. And this is like an expression that I never heard. I always say la casa por la ventana. But the idea is we're going to throw the doors of the house through the windows. That means like we are going all in.
Yeah.
Basically.
That's awesome.
And so they're going to be performing. I'm going to dance a lot. Before that, we'll have Maya Martinez and David Salvatierra from Docho Dance Company. They will give us a little dance introduction so we can learn some steps if we forgot and start warming up. There will be food, a three-course meal provided by Tilda's Kitchen. There will be appetizers, main dish, and dessert that includes churros with chocolate dip churros and other things. So it's going to be great. Drinks are also non-alcoholic drinks are included in the ticket prices. We'll have nominees from the communities. I'm very excited that we put a call out a couple of months ago saying, who do you want to nominate for La Voz Award, like a community award? And we got over 50 nominations.
Oh.
So we have five awardees, people that are part of the community and have been decided on by their own peers. So one is Alejandra Sanchez Surman. She works in Sullivan County as a tutor for the migrant education program. Another one is Cristina Saito. She works for Catholic Charities in the Orange County area. Elin Martinez, she is a volunteer with UIDN, the Ulster Immigrant Defense Network. She's also a student of the Clemente program at Bard. She used to work for Catholic Charities, for Legal Service of the Hudson Valley, so many different service-oriented organizations. Jaime del Raso is a professor at Vassar College whose main focus is undocumented students and also the impact of serving in the army for immigrants and for Latinos. And Laura Lecour, she's a person that has been involved for decades with Rural Migrant Ministry and that covers the hot Hudson Valley area. So those are the nominees, the awardees already. We have a lot of people that have supported, many organizations that are sponsoring the event. There will be a silent auction. And all of this happens in the time period of 6 to 10 p.m.
Yeah, wow. It's going to be busy.
Next Saturday, June 22nd at the Spiegel Tent at Bard College. The ticket prices are $65 for the outer circle or the booths, then $70 and then $80 if you sit closer to the stage. If you ever see any gala, any celebrations like this of nonprofits, the prices are usually $100, $120, $150. We didn't want to do that. Yes, we need funds, but we also want people to attend. We want to be as affordable as possible. Also, you know, we're providing the food, all this entertainment. So that's the price we came up with.
How many people are you expecting?
Well, the space holds like 200 people. So,
wow. And in the last 20 years, what has been your proudest moment?
Makes me happy or me proud when I am at an event or at a place and I see someone who recognizes me and they tell me, I ask them actually, how did you learn about this event? And they say, I saw it in La Voz. I'm here because I saw it in La Voz. And whenever that happens, I'm like, okay, good job. Well done.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the type of things. I'm not interested in, oh, I interview someone who is very famous. Sure, but I'm not into that. I'm like really what people need, being able to be there with that information.
Right, like serving the community.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the 20th anniversary. What are you looking forward? Like what's next for La Voz in the next 20 years, 10 years, the next year? Like what's coming up for you guys and what are you excited about?
Well, I'm very excited that La Voz has taken all the roots that it needed. And I really wanted to continue to put roots in the community. There's always new people coming in, new immigrants, but also new organizations, new businesses. So always be in touch with what is happening. And in terms of systems, as I mentioned, we are two part-time, one full-time, six students that, you know, we continually rotate. So there's a lot of systems in place to make sure that everyone is on board or understands what's the work coming up. So I really like to focus on that and be able to offer internships for students outside of Bard. I would love to do that, internships for journalism students in the area. Also, change a little bit our website. We do have a website, lavoz.bard.edu. It's great, but it could be better. So we want to improve that, be able to post videos on the website, things like that. It has some audio there. So little tweaks that make it stronger.
That was La Voz's managing editor, Mariel Fiore, on their upcoming 20th anniversary celebration at the Spiegel Tent at Bard College on June 22nd from 6 to 10 p.m. In Liberty, I'm Maren Scotton for Radio Catskill.
And we'll take a break. When we come back, Afro Chic at the Deepwater Literary Festival in Narrowsburg this weekend. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Another way to help us bring you the news is donate a vehicle you don't need. Car, truck, motorcycle. You can donate to this station and it could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not. Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. The Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg this weekend, and Radio Catskill is a proud media partner. Every day this week, we've been featuring authors and events from the festival. Janine Hayes and Brian Mason are the founders of Afrochic, one of the nation's most successful Black-owned brands. They're authors of Remix, Decorating with Culture, Objects, and Soul, and Afrochic, Celebrating the Legacy of the Black Family Home, as well as their eponymous magazine. On Saturday at the festival, presented in association with Radio Catskill, they'll be joined by podcaster and award-winning chef Heather Carlucci to discuss the ways writing and publications are natural pathways to building independent businesses and how they're rethinking Afrochic as new upstate residents. And they're joining us now on the phone, now live, Janine and Brian. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, and happy
I was just about to say, happy Juneteenth. Thank you for being here. And let's talk about your business, your brand. It spans publications, digital content, design projects, but you started out way back in 2007 as a blog. Did you guys ever see this evolving into such a large national media brand?
Not at all. not at all when we first started. We actually didn't come from traditional interior design backgrounds. Neither of us went to school for it. Janine at the time was working as a policy attorney in San Francisco, working on the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. And I was kind of a wandering academic. So I was going from school to school, first the Graduate Theological Union and then UC Berkeley collecting master's degrees. And design had always been a creative outlet for Janine. We started the blog trying to, and it's kind of just taken on a life of its own. And then for 17 years, it's been taking us here and there.
You guys, as you said, it was a personal passion for design that's evolved into celebrating creativity across the African diaspora. And you also touch on, you know, how the Black experience combines and is reflected in art and design and family and community. Can you talk a little bit about that and the legacy of the Black family home as featured in your book, Afrochic?
Yes, yes. Well, absolutely. You know, like Brian said, we really started from that passion of home, and we realized that home, you know, covers so many topics. That's what we've been doing these past 17 years, is just understanding what the Black family home means. And in it, it allows us to talk about art and music and fashion, advocacy, scholarship. And when we actually started the work on our book, on our latest book, Afrochic, we were just really, it actually really started with a look at Juneteenth, in 2020. We were reading some articles about Juneteenth and how when people, you know, were emancipated, how there was no idea of home for those who were emancipated at that time. They lived in a plantation setting, which was not homey in any way whatsoever. And then were released basically out into the streets of many towns and communities all across the United States. So we wanted to understand a lot more about that history and how home came to grow, came to develop for African Americans. And that story has been one that has just been, it's beautiful. It's a story of great resilience, and it's a story that touches every American community. We even found here in Ulster County, we've learned about Sojourner Truth and her journey here in Ulster County and her own efforts at liberation and also working to retain her family and retain that home for herself.
So as we've gone, home has become more than a place. It's become a lens for us, a way of looking at our own culture, global culture, and the processes of history that have created it. So a lot of what we do now is about actually taking people through that lens and seeing everything that's on the other side. That's why our magazine is able to combine so many different aspects of African diaspora culture, Black culture around the world, and why our website, as we've created and designed, is essentially thought of as a virtual home. We bring all of these different things together for people to not only explore and read, but also to interact with and spend time with in what is a virtual safe space.
And you, there's so much. You guys have, you know, lifestyle and news, a shop, the magazine, podcasts, Afro-Chic TV. You mentioned you're in Ulster County. Does that give you some respite as well as some inspiration for all of these great projects at Afro-Chic?
Yes, it definitely does. We moved to Ulster County from Brooklyn in 2020. And so, you know, it's been interesting first getting used to that of, you know, being outside of the city. And, you know, there are times when we still miss the noisiness of the city. But we have found that as writers in particular, it's really nice to be in more wide open space. That helps us to think better, being able to commune with nature more, being able to have time for the mind to rest. So that we can, you know, go into all these different creative endeavors. So we are definitely, you know, loving our new home and all of the green, the greenness and the animals and, you know, all the nature that we never expected we'd
yeah.
like, but we're actually loving it.
And that must...
Go ahead. I was saying, and we found so much to inspire us up here, not only the beauty of the nature, but as you mentioned, all of our different areas and platforms, everything that we do is kind of driven by narrative. And there is so much of the narrative of Black history to be found here, not only in terms of, yes, we know slavery was a part of the New York and Northern experience of the Dutch originally and later through the English, and Sojourner Truth was born up here, but then also, you know, these amazing stories like Peg Leg Bates, who was a one-legged tap dancer who had traveled and performed around the world, a number of other places and people who have been up here, you know, Sonny Rollins, Gail Ann Dorsey. There's so much musical and cultural literary history to this area.
Yeah, I was going to say it's such a diverse narrative of the Black experience, and being now on the countryside of that, you're finding different things that help, you know, showcase that even more through design, art, and everything you're doing at Afro-Chic. Are you looking forward to being at the Deepwater Literary Festival? Talk a little bit more about it in your backyard, so to speak.
Yes, we are really looking forward to Saturday and sitting down and speaking, you know, at the festival. Anytime we are at, you know, an event and can meet and connect with people around the book is very exciting to us, and just all of the different work we do. Heather Carlucci, who is the moderator, is a dear friend. So it's really going to be just a fun conversation. And after the conversation, we'll sign books, and we're really excited to learn other people's stories of home. That's always one of the highlights of touring and work and going to a festival, is actually being able to sit down and hear from the people in the audience and their own experiences of home.
And again, that's Saturday at the Deepwater Literary Festival. And that's going to be with Heather Carlucci, presented in association with Radio Catskill. There's more information about this conversation at deepwaterfestival.com. And of course, more about Afro-Chic at afrochic.com. Check it out. It is a really expansive and really well-produced website. I hope you guys are getting some rest, because I can see all the work that goes into it.
Yes, we get it where we can.
All right. Thank you guys for joining us. I look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Remember, you can hear this show, other programs, other locally produced programs, all of our news stories, too, on our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, check out One Small Step. That is the partnership with StoryCorps, where we're bringing diverse strangers together, people that don't know each other, that might have an opposing viewpoint, to have a conversation, not about politics, but to get to know each other and discover the humanity in all of us. It's One Small Step. Go to the website, check it out, fill out the questionnaire, and become part of it. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County.
Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. The heat advisory remains in effect until 8 p.m. tomorrow. Sunny, hot, humid. Stay hydrated with these temperatures remaining so dangerously high. It's 83 here in Liberty, but the real feel heat index puts it at 97. Looking ahead, thunderstorms, some heavy tomorrow afternoon through tomorrow evening. On Point's next.